If it is your purpose to evaluate whether you want to read a book or not, you pick it up, you look at the beginning of it, maybe you check out the end, if it's an Agatha Christie book. You leaf through the pages, you try to figure out, is this something that you want to read? If it has an index, you look through the index. There's a wonderful story about William Buckley, who wrote his memoirs, and he sent a copy to Norman Mailer, and next to Mailer's name in the index, he wrote, "Hi, Norman." Because he figured that would be the first place he would look, is to check for his name. You see if there are things in the index that interest you. And then, based on that and all sorts of other ancillary considerations, like maybe the cover design and whether someone else has told you that it's good, you read the book. In other words, you look at the beginning, at the end, and then about some vague sense of what this book is about. And on the basis of that, you evaluate it. Next week is the holiday of Shavuot, when we celebrate the giving of the Torah. So let's look at the beginning and the end, and a general sense of it, and see if maybe in this coming year we might actually decide to take the time to read it. The beginning of the Torah, the beginning of the Bible, is very well known. The beginning is in the beginning. Bereshit, sometimes translated as at the beginning of creation or in the beginning of creating. But of course the next word subverts, that means undermines, contradicts what went before, because it says, in the beginning, God. That means God must have been there before the beginning. Because if you're talking about someone who did something at the beginning, they must have already been there. So in the beginning isn't the beginning. And the attentive reader who looks at the beginning of the Torah understands, first of all, that this is a book that's going to work on a lot of different levels. And second, that it says at the outset, there are things that however much you explore, you won't fully understand. And third, that nothing begins when you think it does. And that's true in life. Is there any action we take for which we can't trace a previous action that caused that, and a previous one that caused the second one, and so on forever and ever? That's what it means to have a plot. You know, in his novel, in his rather book about novels called Aspects of the Novel, E.M. Forster says the difference between a story and a plot is that a plot is caused by something. So he says, the king died and the queen died is a story. The king died and the queen died of grief is a plot. When something happens because of what happened before, it's a plot. And everything that happens to us happens because of something before it. And if you trace that back to the very beginning in the Bible, what do you find? You find God. And therefore, at the beginning of the Bible is the statement that everything that follows will in some ways be an outgrowth of the notion that there is one overarching, mysterious, unknowable cause that gives birth to the world. This is already a very interesting way to start a book. Especially when you know nothing about that character. It introduces the main character of the book and tells you nothing about, for example, the question the children always ask. Who were God's parents? Where did God come from? How did God get to be so powerful? God's character does not unfold at the beginning, only gradually in the book. And so, as the attentive reader, the attentive hypothetical reader here at the airport, about to get on the plane, wondering whether you should read this book, you quickly flip to the end. And when you flip to the end, you see that the last word of the book is Israel. And having, of course, leafed through the book, with one eye at the departure gate, both literally and metaphorically, having leafed through the book, you know why it says Israel at the end. Because the entire book is about this people being led by God to the land of Israel. But actually, if you read enough of the end, you'll see that at the end of the book, they're still not in the land of Israel. That even though the entire purpose of the book seems to be to get them across the wilderness and into the land, when you finish the five books of Moses, they're still in the wilderness. And that last word, Israel, does not refer to the land. It refers to the people. So now you understand something else about the book, which is that the goal of the book is not to put the people somewhere. The goal of the book is to make them into Israel. It is not about land acquisition nearly as much as it is about character formation. God won't put them in Israel until they become Israel. In other words, this book is not about where you get to, but about who you become. And the goal, whatever your goal is for your life, is not, in fact, something that you reach externally. It's about your character. Character is fate, as the Greeks used to say. So it begins with a cause that you can't understand and ends with a goal that you never reach. But if you only know the beginning and the end of the book and don't know its purpose, you are likely to put it back on the rack and go onto the plane with Grisham, which would be a tragedy. Because what you would miss is what the book is supposed to do, which is not like a Grisham novel to while away a few hours. In fact, in order to understand the Torah, I'm going to use as an example a very American, maybe the most American, of philosophers, William James. William James developed, didn't invent, but he developed a theory of truth called pragmatism. And pragmatism said that the truth of any idea is how it works in practice. That you can't evaluate an idea abstractly. You have to know what he called the cash value of an idea. And to make this more concrete to understand it, one of the examples that James gives is a fish hook. He says, when you cast a fish hook into the sea, the fish that swims around the hook knows better the truth of the hook than the one that bites it. Because to say that a fish hook is just a small piece of metal doesn't tell the truth about it. The truth about it is not what it is, but what it does. And that's what I want to suggest about the Torah. The truth of this book can't be known in the telling of it. It has to move through our lives. It's what it does, not what it is. It's the way that it changes us, not simply the stories it contains. You can know everything about the Torah and still not know the Torah. You know the man who came to the rabbi referring to the Talmud, not the Torah, but referring to the Talmud and said, "You know, Rabbi, I don't mean to boast," which is always the prelude to a boast, right? Nobody ever says, "I don't mean to boast," and then says something negative about themselves, right? They always say, "I don't mean to boast, but really I'm wonderful." He says, "I don't mean to boast, but I've been through the Talmud 3 times. And the rabbi says, "That's very nice, but what I want to know is how much of the Talmud has been through you." If the Torah goes through you, then you will know what the rabbis say about the mitzvot. They say the only purpose of the mitzvot is litzaref et habriyot, to refine human character. That's why they're there. To make us different. It is, if you will, the cash value of the book. The way it changes our lives. What it does to us that makes it special. And not only what it does to us, but by the way, what it has done to all of us historically. How it is that this small and harassed people has managed to endure for thousands of years. And if you had to give one answer, the answer would be because of that book. Because it has somehow, in a way that is magical, mysterious, inexplicable, taken a people and made them gradually into Israel, concretized them, stiffened their spine, turned them to God. Tomorrow, we're going to finish the writing of a Sefer Torah. We have a couple hundred letters left to be filled in, and people are going to come who have participated in this writing of the Torah, and they are going to take the hand of the sofer, of the scribe, and they will fill in the letters that will end the Torah. And then they will have participated in, as we explained last night, the very last mitzvah of the Torah, which is to write a Torah. But the mitzvah is empty unless what you write touches you. The Torah doesn't mean anything if it's just a book on your coffee table. And that's why we're writing the Torah now. Because we are doing it in time for Shavuot, which is next week. And Shavuot is one of 3 regalim, 3 festivals. Just a moment ago, I was in the chapel where there is a large and wonderful religious school Shabbaton with hundreds of religious school kids and their parents. And I want to conclude this morning by telling you what I told them. The reason the Shalosh Regalim are called Regalim Regel, the 3 festivals are called Regalim Regel, also means leg. It's when people would make a pilgrimage up to Jerusalem. And they would do it 3 times during the year, on Passover, on Sukkot, and on Shavuot. Now on Passover, we have a Seder. On Sukkot, we have a Sukkah. What do we have on Shavuot? Nothing. Nothing. You can eat a cheese blintz, right? There's a tradition of having dairy on Shavuot. It's not, you know, it's not nearly as dramatic as the bread of affliction. And I asked the kids, rhetorically, because I really intended to tell them, but I asked them, why is it that Pesach has something? I mean, everybody knows the Seder. Everybody loves the Seder. Sukkot has something very tangible, very idiosyncratic, very strange. In fact, I have a good Sukkot story. Can I interrupt myself to tell you a great Sukkot story that someone told me last Sukkot? I don't know why, but it's a good story, and you always have time for a good story. There was, I think it was in Los Angeles, where a guy put up a sukkah in his backyard and his neighbors complained because the only way that he could do the sukkah was it overhung the next door neighbor's yard. And so he took it to, I guess, small claims court, whatever court, and the judge happened to be Jewish. And the judge said, "You're absolutely right, I'm giving him 8 days to take it down." So, see, it was worth stopping the... Anyway. So on Passover you have the Seder. On Sukkot you have the Sukkot, but on Shavuot you have nothing. And here is what I believe to be the reason underneath this strange absence of practice. On Passover, we're celebrating the Exodus from Egypt. We say each person should feel ki'ilu as if he or she was a slave in Egypt. But are you a slave in Egypt? No. You're talking about something that was, but is no longer. And we all know, to remember the past, you need a souvenir, right? You have to take pictures of the trip or you'll forget where you were. Sukkot remembers the wandering through the desert. We don't wander through the desert anymore. We're not in a desert anymore, except in another sense. We live in Los Angeles, not in the desert. So you need a sukkah, because it reminds us of where we were. But Shavuot celebrates the giving and receiving of the Torah. And that's not something that is supposed to have happened only in the past. It happens all the time. Every time you're touched by a single word of the Torah, you're at Sinai. Every time you change something about your life because it has moved you or inspired you or uplifted somebody near you, and their influence has changed you, you're at Sinai. So you don't need a reminder on Shavuot, because it's not about what was, it's about what is. When we complete the Torah tomorrow, we are doing something that we do every single day, which is add a new letter to the scroll that began at Sinai, although, as we know, it didn't just begin there, because there is no clear, sharp beginning, but something that never ends. I hope that you will join us, if you can, in celebration tomorrow, and even more on Shavuot. On the night of Shavuot, when we will be studying together and also be studying with a great Israeli commentator, political commentator, scholar, teacher, translator, Hillel Halkin, on Saturday night next week. But even more, I hope that you will take the rabbi's advice, the rabbi in the story, and let the Torah go through you. Because if it does, you will have not just the joy, but the spiritual satisfaction of discovering that the words and the stories and the laws are all of them in some way a pretext for the mystery of how a Torah operates on a soul. And when it moves through us, it changes us. And that's why, at the very end of the Torah, we become Israel. It binds us one to another. It changes our hearts. And it draws us closer to God. This year, I pray that we will stand at Sinai again and again and understand what the rabbis teach. That if everything in the world were silent for a moment, you would still hear the echo of God's voice reverberating from the mountain. Which means that if you are silent in your soul, just for a second, and you listen, you will hear it, and it will change you. Shabbat Shalom.